she said. Why didn't you tell me about him getting put in jail? She looked so normal standing there. For a moment, none of us moved. We watched her like we were waiting for the roof to cave in. But May just stood there, calm as she could be. I started thinking maybe some sort of miracle had taken place and she'd somehow gotten cured. You all right? Said August, easing to her feet. May didn't answer. May, June said. I even smiled over at Rosalina, nodded, as if to say, can you believe how well she's taking this? August, though, turned off the television and studied May, frowning. May's head was angled to the side, and her eyes were fixed on a cross-stitched picture of a birdhouse that hung on the wall. It struck me all of a sudden that her eyes weren't actually seeing the picture. They had glazed completely over. August went over to May. Answer me, are you all right? In the silence, I heard May's breathing grow loud and a little ragged. She took several steps backward until she came to the wall. Then she slid down onto the floor without making a sound. I'm not sure when it sank in that May had gone off to some unreachable place inside herself. Even August and June didn't realize it right away. They called her name like she'd only lost her hearing. Rosaline bent over May and spoke in a loud voice, trying to get through to her.
Zack is gonna be all right. You don't need to worry any. Mr. Forrest is getting him out of jail on Wednesday.
May stared straight ahead like Rosaline wasn't even there.
What's happened to her? June asked, and I could hear a note of panic in her voice. I've never seen her like this.
May was here but not here. Her hands lay limp in her lap, palms up. No sobbing into her dress skirt, no rocking back and forth, no pulling at her braids. She was so quiet, so different. I turned my face to the ceiling. I just couldn't watch. August went to the kitchen and came back with a dish towel filled with ice. She pulled May's head to her so it rested against her shoulder for a minute. Then she lifted her sister's face and pressed the towel to May's forehead and temples and along her neck. She kept on doing this for several minutes, then put the cloth down and tapped May's cheeks with her hands. May blinked a time or two and looked at August. She looked at all of us, huddled above her, as if she were returning from a long trip.
You feel better? Said August.
May nodded.
I'll be okay.
Her words came out in an odd monotone.
Well, I'm glad to see you can talk, said June. Come on, let's get you in the bathtub.
August and June pulled May to her feet.
I'm going to the wall, May said.
June shook her head.
It's getting dark.
Just for a little while, May said.
She moved into the kitchen, with all of us following after her. She opened a cabinet drawer, took out a flashlight, her tablet, a stub of a pencil, and walked onto the porch. I pictured her writing it down, Zack in jail, and pushing it into a crevice in the wall. I felt somebody should personally thank every rock out there for the human misery it had absorbed. We should kiss them one by one and say, we are sorry, but something strong and lasting had to do this for May, and you are the chosen ones. God bless your rock hearts.
I'll go with you, said August.
May spoke over her shoulder.
No, please, August, just me.
August started to protest,
but just me,
said May, turning to face us.
Just me.
We watched her go down the porch steps and move into the trees. In life, there are things you can't get over, no matter how hard you try, and that sight is one of them. May, walking into the trees, with the little circle of light bobbing in front of her, then swallowed up by the dark.
A bee's life is but short. During spring and summer, the most strenuous periods of foraging, a worker bee, as a rule, does not live more than 4 or 5 weeks. Threatened by all kinds of dangers during their foraging flights, many workers die before they have reached even that age. The Dancing Bees. Chapter 10. I sat in the kitchen with August, June, and Rosaline while the night spread out around the house. May had been gone a whole 5 minutes when August got up and began to pace. She walked out to the porch and back and then stared out toward the wall. After 20 minutes, she said, "That's it. Let's go get her." She got the flashlight from the truck and struck out for the wall, while June, Rosaline, and I hurried to keep pace. A night bird was singing from a tree branch, just singing its heart out, urgent and feverish, like it was put there to sing the moon up to the top of the sky. "May," called August. June called too, then Rosaline and me. We went along shouting her name, but no sound came back. Just the night bird, singing up the moon. After we walked from one end of the wailing wall to the other, we went back and walked it again, like this time we were going to get it right. Walk slower, look closer, call louder. This time May would be there, kneeling with the flashlight batteries burned out. We would think, "My goodness, how did we miss her here the first time?" That didn't happen, though. So we walked into the woods behind the wall, calling her name louder and louder till I could hear the hoarseness creeping into our throats. But not one of us would say, "Something is terribly wrong." Despite the night, the heat had lingered on bad as ever, and I could smell the hot dampness of our bodies as we combed the woods with a spot of light 4 inches across. Finally, August said, "June, you go to the house and call the police. Tell them we need help to find our sister. When you hang up, you kneel before Our Lady and beg her to watch over May. Then you come back. We're going to walk toward the river." June took off running. We could hear her crashing through the brush as we turned toward the back of the property where the river flowed. August's legs moved faster and faster. Rosaline struggled to keep up, gulping for air. When we reached the river, we stood there a moment. I'd been in Tiburon long enough for the full moon to fade away and grow back full again. It hung over the river, sliding in and out of clouds. I stared at a tree on the opposite bank, where the roots were exposed and twisted, and felt a metallic dry taste rise from the back of my throat and slide over my tongue. I reached for August's hand, but she had turned right and was moving along the bank calling May's name. "May!" Rosaline and I moved behind her in our clumsy knot, so close we must have seemed to the night creatures like one big organism with 6 legs. I was surprised when the prayer we said after dinner each night, the one with the beads, started up of its own accord and recited itself in the back reaches of my head. I could hear each word plainly. "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen." It wasn't till August said, "Good, Lily, we should all pray," that I realized I'd been repeating it out loud. I couldn't tell if I was saying it as a prayer or muttering it as a way to push down the fear. August said the words with me, and then Rosaline did too. We walked along the river with the words streaming behind us like ribbons in the night. When June came back, she was holding another flashlight she dug up somewhere at the house. The puddle of light wobbled as she came through the woods. "Over here," called August, aiming her flashlight up through the trees. We waited for June to reach the riverbank. "The police are on their way," she said. "The police are coming." I looked at Rosaline, at the ends of her mouth turned down. The police hadn't recognized me the day I'd visited the jail. I hoped they didn't get lucky with Rosaline. June shouted May's name and plowed up the riverbank into the dark, followed by Rosaline, but August moved slowly now, carefully. I stayed close behind her, saying Hail Marys to myself faster and faster. Suddenly August stopped in her tracks. I stopped too, and I didn't hear the night bird singing anymore. I watched August, not taking my eyes off her. She stood tense and alert, staring down at the bank, at something I could not see.
June,
she called in a strange, whispery voice, but June and Rosaline had pushed farther up the riverbank and didn't hear. Only I heard. The air felt thick and charged, too thick to breathe. I stepped over beside August, letting my elbow touch her arm, needing the weight of her next to me. And there was May's flashlight, shut off and sitting on the wet ground. It seems odd to me now how we went on standing there another minute, me waiting for August to say something, but she didn't speak, just stood, soaking up that last moment. A wind rose up, raking its sound along the tree branches, hitting our faces like an oven blast, like the sudden breezes of hell. August looked at me, then moved her flashlight beam out to the water. The light swept across the surface, making a spatter of ink-gold splotches before it stopped abruptly. May lay in the river, just beneath the surface. Her eyes were wide open and unblinking, and the skirt of her dress fanned out and swayed in the current. I heard a noise come from August's lips, a soft moan. I clutched frantically at August's arm, but she pulled free of me, threw down her flashlight, and waded into the river. I splashed in after her. Water surged around my legs, causing me to fall once on the slippery bottom. I grabbed for August's skirt, just missing. I came up, sputtering. When I reached her, August was staring down at her baby sister.
June!
She shouted.
June!
May lay in 2 feet of water, with a huge river stone on top of her chest. It weighted her body, holding it on the bottom. Looking at her, I thought, she will get up now. August will roll away the stone, and May will come up for air, and we will go back to the house and get her dry. I wanted to reach down and touch her, shake her shoulder a little. She couldn't have died out here in the river. That would be impossible. The only parts of her not submerged were her hands. They floated, her palms little ragged cups bobbing on the surface, the water weaving in and out of her fingers. Even now, that's the picture that will wake me up in the night. Not May's eyes, open and staring, or the stone resting on her like a grave slab. Her hands. June came thrashing into the water. When she reached May, she stood beside August, panting, her arms dangling beside her body.
Oh, May,
she whispered, and looked away, squeezing her eyes closed. Glancing toward the bank, I saw Rosaline standing ankle-deep in the river, her whole body shaking. August knelt down in the water and shoved the stone off May's chest. Grabbing May by the shoulders, she pulled her up. Her body made an awful sucking sound as it broke the surface. Her head rolled back, and I saw that her mouth was partially open, and her teeth were rimmed with mud. River reeds clung to her hair braids. I looked away. I knew then. May was dead. August knew, too, but she put her ear to May's chest, listening. After a minute, though, she drew back and pulled May's head to her breast, and it almost seemed like she wanted May to listen now for her heart.
We've lost her, August said.
I started to shiver. I could hear my teeth and my mouth crashing against each other. August and June scooped their arms under May's body and struggled to carry her to the bank. She was saturated, bulging. I grabbed her ankles and tried to steady them. The river, it seemed, had carried away her shoes. When they laid her down on the bank, water gushed from her mouth and nostrils. I thought, this is the way Our Lady came, washing up on the river near Charleston. I thought, look at her fingers, her hands. They are so precious. I imagined how May had rolled the rock from the bank out into the river, then lay down pulling it on top of her. She had held it tight like a baby and waited for her lungs to fill. I wondered if she had flailed and jerked toward the surface at the last second, or did she go without fighting, embracing the rock, letting it soak up all the pain she felt? I wondered about the creatures that had swum by while she died. June and August, sopping wet, stooped on either side of her, while mosquitoes sang in our ears and the river went on about its business, coiling off into the darkness. I was sure they'd pictured May's last moments, too, but I didn't see horror on their faces now, just a heartbroken acceptance. This had been the thing they'd been waiting for half their lives without even realizing it. August tried to close May's eyes with her fingers, but they would only stay half shut.
"It's just like April," June said. "Hold the flashlight on May for me," August said to her.
The words came out quiet and steady. I could barely hear them over the bamming of my heart. By the small beam of light, August plucked out the tiny green leaves stuck in the plaits in May's hair and tucked each one into her pocket. August and June scraped off every piece of river debris there was from May's skin and clothes, and Rosaline, poor Rosaline, who I realized had lost her new best friend, stood, not making a sound, but with her chin shaking so awful I wanted to reach up and hold it for her. Then a sound I will never forget whooshed out of May's mouth. A long, bubbling sigh, and we all looked at each other, confused, with a second of actual hope, as if the miracle of miracles was about to take place after all. But it was only a pocket of swallowed air that had suddenly been released. It swept across my face, smelling like the river, like a piece of old wood that had gone moldy. I looked down at May's face and felt a wave of nausea. Stumbling off into the trees, I bent over and vomited. Afterward, as I wiped my mouth on the hem of my shirt, I heard a sound break through the darkness, a cry so piercing it made the bottom of my heart drop. Looking back, I saw August framed in the light of June's flashlight, the sound coming from deep in her throat. When it faded away, she dropped her head straight down onto May's soggy chest. I reached for the limb of a small cedar and held tight, as though everything I had was about to slip from my hands.
"So you're an orphan?" the policeman said.
It was that tall, crew-cut Eddie Hazelwurst who'd escorted August and me in to see Zack in jail. Rosaline and I sat in the rocking chairs in the parlor, while he stood before us holding a small notebook, ready to capture every word. The other policeman was outside searching around the wailing wall for what I couldn't imagine. My chair rocked so fast I was in danger of being pitched out of it. Rosaline's, however, remained motionless, her face closed down. When we'd first gotten back to the house after finding May, August had met both policemen and then sent me and Rosaline upstairs.
"Go on up there and get dried off," she'd said to me.
I'd peeled off my shoes and rubbed myself with a towel while we stood at the upstairs window. We'd watched the men from the ambulance bring May back from the woods on a stretcher, then listened as the two policemen asked August and June all sorts of questions. Their voices had floated up the stairwell. "Yes, she's been depressed lately. Well, actually, she was depressed on and off all the time. She had a condition. She couldn't seem to distinguish other people's suffering from her own." "No, we didn't find a note."
"An autopsy?"
"All right, we understand." Mr. Hazelwurst had wanted to talk to everyone, so here we were. I'd told him exactly what happened from the time May answered the telephone to the moment we found her in the river. Then he started with the personal questions. "Wasn't I that girl who came to the jail last week to see one of the colored boys? What was I doing staying here? Who was Rosaline?" I explained everything about my mother dying when I was small, my father going to his maker earlier this summer after a tractor accident, which was the story I was sticking with. "Rosaline," I said, "was my nanny." "I guess you could say I'm an orphan," I told him. "But I've got family in Virginia. It was my father's dying wish for me to go live with my Aunt Bernie. She's expecting me and Rosaline both.
She'll be sending us bus fare or driving down here and picking us up herself. She keeps saying, Lily, I can't wait for you to get here. I tell her, just so we're there before school starts. I'll be a sophomore, which I cannot believe. He narrowed his eyes like he was trying to follow all this. I was breaking every rule of successful lying. Do not talk so much, I told myself, but I couldn't seem to stop. I'm so happy about going to live with her up there. She's real nice. You wouldn't believe all the stuff she sent me over the years, especially costume jewelry and teddy bears, one bear after another. I was only glad August and June were not present to hear this. They had left to follow the ambulance in the honey wagon, wanting to see May's body delivered safe and sound to wherever it was going. It was bad enough Rosaline was in the room. I was afraid she was going to give us away, say something like, "Actually, we came here right after Lily broke me out of jail." But she sat drawn into herself, a complete mute. "Now, what was your last name again?" he said. "Williams," I said. I had told him this twice already, so I had to wonder what kind of educational requirements they had for policemen in Tiburon. It looked like the same ones as Sylvan. He drew up even taller. "Well, what I don't understand is, if you're going to live with your aunt in Virginia, what are you doing here?"
Here is the translation. "I am completely confused what a white girl like you is doing staying in a colored house."
I took a breath. "Well, see, my Aunt Bernie had to have an operation. It was female trouble. So Rosaline over there said, why don't me and you stay with my friend August Boatwright in Tiburon till Aunt Bernie gets on her feet again? It was no sense in us going up there while she was in the hospital."
He was actually writing this down. "Why?" I wanted to yell at him. "This is not about me and Rosaline and Aunt Bernie's operation. This is about May. She's dead, or haven't you noticed?" I should have been in my room right then crying my eyeballs out, and here I was having the stupidest conversation of my life.
"Didn't you have any white people back in Spartanburg you could stay with?"
Translation: anything would be better than you staying in a colored house. "No, sir, not really. I didn't have that many friends. For some reason, I didn't fit in that well with the crowd. I think it was because I made such good grades. One lady at church said I could stay there till Aunt Bernie got well, but then she got shingles, and there went that."
"Lord God, somebody stop me."
He looked at Rosaline.
"So, how did you know August?"
I held my breath, aware that my rocking chair had come to a standstill.
"She's my husband's first cousin," Rosaline said. "Me and her kept up after my husband left me. August was the only one of his family who knew what a sorry jackass he was."
She cut her eyes at me as if to say, "See, you aren't the only one who can concoct lies at the drop of a hat." He flipped his notebook shut, and crooking his finger at me, motioned me to follow him to the door. After he stepped outside, he said, "Take my advice and call your aunt and tell her to come on and get you, even if she isn't 100% well. These are colored people here. You understand what I'm saying?"
I wrinkled up my forehead.
"No, sir, I'm afraid I don't."
"I'm just saying it's not natural that you shouldn't be, well, lowering yourself."
"Oh.
I'm gonna come back soon, and I better not find you still here, okay?"
He smiled and put his gigantic hand on my head like we were two white people with a secret understanding.
"Okay."
I closed the door behind him. Whatever glue had kept me together throughout all that cracked then. I walked back into the parlor, already starting to sob. Rosaline put her arm around me, and I saw tears coming down her face, too. We walked up the stairs to the room she'd shared with May. Rosaline pulled down the sheets on her bed.
"Go on, get in," she told me.
"But where will you sleep?"
"Right over here," she answered, pulling back the covers on May's bed, The pink and brown afghan May had crocheted with popcorn stitches. Rosaline climbed in and pushed her face into the creases of the pillow. I knew she was smelling for May's scent. You'd think I would have dreamed about May, but when I fell asleep, it was Zack who came. I can't even tell you what was happening in the dream. I woke up, my breath panting a little, and I knew it had been about him. He seemed close and real, like I could sit up and touch my fingertips to his cheek. Then I remembered where he was, and an unbearable heaviness came over me. I pictured his cot with his shoes sitting under it, how he was probably lying awake this very moment watching the ceiling, listening to the other boys breathe. Across the room, a rustling noise startled me, and I had one of those strange moments where you don't know quite where you are. Only half awake, I thought I was in the honey house, but it came to me now that the sound was Rosaline turning over in bed. And then I remembered May. I remembered her in the river. I had to get up, slip into the bathroom, and throw water on my face. I was standing there with the nightlight casting its small brightness when I looked down and saw the claw-footed tub wearing the red socks May had put on its porcelain feet. I smiled then. I couldn't help it. It was the sight of May I never wanted to forget. I closed my eyes, and all the best pictures of her came to me. I saw her corkscrew braids glistening in the sprinkler, her fingers arranging the graham cracker crumbs, working so hard on behalf of a single roach's life. And that hat she wore the day she danced the conga line with the Daughters of Mary. Mostly, though, I saw the blaze of love and anguish that had come so often into her face. In the end, it had burned her up. After the autopsy, after the police had made her suicide official, after the funeral home had fixed May up as pretty as they could, she came home to the pink house. First thing Wednesday morning, August 5th, a black hearse pulled up in the driveway, and four men in dark suits lifted out May's casket and brought it right into the parlor. When I asked August why May was coming through the front door in her coffin, she said, "We're going to sit with her till she's buried." I hadn't expected this, as all the people I knew in Sylvan had their dead loved ones go straight from the funeral home to the graveyard. August said, "We sit with her so we can tell her goodbye. It's called a vigil. Sometimes people have a hard time letting death sink in. They can't say goodbye. A vigil helps us do that." If the dead person is right there in your living room, it would certainly make things sink in better. It was strange to think about a dead person in the house, but if it helped us say goodbye better, then okay, I could see the point of it. "It helps May, too," August said. "Helps May?" "You know we all have a spirit, Lily, and when we die, it goes back to God, but nobody really knows how long that takes. Maybe it takes a split second, and maybe it takes a week or two. Anyway, when we sit with May, we're saying, 'It's okay, May. We know this is your home, but you can go now. It'll be all right.'" August had them roll the coffin, which sat on its own table with wheels, in front of Our Lady of Chains, and then open it up. After the funeral home men drove away, August and Rosaline walked up to the coffin and stared down at May, but I hung back. I was walking around, inspecting myself in the various mirrors, when June came down with a cello and began to play. She played "Oh, Susanna," which made all of us smile. There's nothing like a small joke at a vigil to help you relax. I walked up to the coffin and stood between August and Rosaline. It was the same old May, except her skin was pulled tight across her face bones. The lamplight spilling into the coffin gave her a kind of glow. They had her wearing a royal blue dress I'd never seen, with pearl buttons and a boatneck collar, and a blue hat. She looked like any second she would pop open her eyes and grin at us.
This was the woman who taught my mother everything there was to know about getting rid of roaches in a nice way. I counted on my fingers the days since May had told me about my mother staying here. 6. It seemed like 6 months. I still wanted so badly to tell August what I knew. I guess I could have told Rosaline, but it was really August I wanted to tell. She was the only one who knew what any of it meant. Standing at the coffin, looking up at August, I had a powerful urge to tell her right then, just blurt it out. I'm not Lily Williams, I'm Lily Owens, and it was my mother who stayed here. May told me. And then it would all come out. Whatever terrible things might happen, would. When I peered up at her, though, she was brushing tears off her face, looking for a handkerchief in her pocket, and I knew it would be selfish to pour this into her cup when it was already to the brim with grief for May. June played with her eyes closed, as if May's spirit getting into heaven depended solely on her. You've never heard such music, how it made us believe death was nothing but a doorway. August and Rosaline finally sat down, but once I was up at the coffin, I found I couldn't leave. May's arms were crossed over her chest, wings folded in on themselves, a pose I did not find flattering. I reached in and held her hand. It was waxy cool, but I didn't care. "I hope you will be happier in heaven," I told her. "I hope you will not need any kind of wall up there. And if you see Mary, Our Lady, tell her we know Jesus is the main one down here, but we're doing our best to keep her memory going." For some reason, I felt exactly like May's spirit was hovering in a corner of the ceiling, hearing every word, even though I wasn't speaking out loud. "And I wish you would look up my mother," I said. "Tell her you saw me, that I'm at least away from T-Ray for the time being. Say this to her. Lily would appreciate a sign letting her know that you love her. Doesn't have to be anything big, but please send something." I let out a long breath, still holding her dead hand, thinking how big her fingers felt in mine. "So I guess this is goodbye," I told her. A shudder went through me, a burning along my eyelashes. Tears fell off my cheeks and spotted her dress. Before I left her, though, I rearranged her a little. I folded her hands together and tucked them under her chin like she was thinking seriously about the future. At 10 o'clock that morning, while June was playing more songs for May and Rosaline was poking around in the kitchen, I sat on the back porch steps with my notebook, trying to write everything down, but really I was watching for August. She had gone out to the wailing wall. I pictured her out there working her pain into the spaces around the stones. By the time I spotted her coming back, I'd stopped writing and was doodling in the margins. She paused halfway across the yard and stared toward the driveway, shielding her eyes from the sun. "Look who's here," she yelled, breaking into a run. I had never seen August run before, and I could not believe how quickly she crossed the grass with her loping strides, her long legs stretched out under her skirt. "It's Zack," she shouted at me, and I dropped my notebook and flew down the steps. I heard Rosaline behind me in the kitchen shouting to June that Zack was here. Heard June's music stop in the middle of a note. When I got to the driveway, he was climbing out of Clayton's car. August wrapped him up in her arms. Clayton stared at the ground and smiled. When August turned Zack loose, I saw how much skinnier he looked. He stood there, watching me. I couldn't read the expression on his face. I walked up to him, wishing I knew the right thing to say. A breeze tossed a piece of my hair across my face, and he reached out and brushed it away. Then he pulled me hard against his chest and held me for a few moments. "Are you all right?" June said, rushing up and cupping his jaw in her hand. "We've been worried sick." "I'm fine now,"
Zack said, but something I couldn't put my finger on had evaporated from his face. Clayton said, the girl who sells tickets at the theater, well, apparently she saw the whole thing. It took her long enough, but she finally told the police which one of the boys threw the bottle. So they dropped the charges against Zack.
Oh, thank God, said August, and every one of us seemed to breathe out all at once.
We just wanted to come by and say how sorry we are about May, Clayton said. He embraced August, then June. When he turned to me, he placed his hands on my shoulders, not an embrace, but close.
Lily, how nice to see you again, he said, then looked at Rosaline, who was hanging back by the car. You too, Rosaline.
August took Rosaline's hand and pulled her over, then went on holding it, the way she used to hold May's sometimes, and it struck me that she loved Rosaline, that she would like to change Rosaline's name to July and bring her into their sisterhood.
I couldn't believe it when Mr. Forrest told me about May, said Zack.
Walking back to the house so Clayton and Zack could take their turns beside the casket, I was thinking, I wish I'd rolled my hair. I wish I'd done it in one of those new beehive hairdos. We all gathered around May. Clayton bowed his head, but Zack stared into her face. We stood there and stood there. Rosaline made a little humming sound, I think out of awkwardness, but eventually she stopped. I looked over at Zack, and the tears were pouring down his cheeks.
I'm sorry, he said. It was all my fault. If I'd turned in the one who threw the bottle, I wouldn't have gotten arrested and none of this would have happened.
I had thought maybe he would never find out it was his arrest that sent May to the river. But that had been too much to hope for.
Who told you? I said.
He waved his hand like it didn't matter.
My mother heard it from Otis. She didn't want to tell me, but she knew I'd hear it from somewhere sooner or later.
He wiped his face.
I just wish I'd...
August reached over and touched Zack's arm. She said,
Well now, I guess I could say if I'd told May from the beginning about you getting arrested instead of keeping it from her, none of this would have happened. Or if I'd stopped May from going out to the wall that night, none of this would have happened. What if I hadn't waited so long before going out there and getting her?
She looked down at May's body.
It was May who did it, Zack.
I was afraid, though, the blame would find a way to stick to them. That's how blame was.
I could use your help right now to drape the hives, August said to Zack as they started to leave. You remember, like we did when Esther died.
Looking over at me, she said,
Esther was a daughter of Mary who died last year.
Sure, I can stay and help, said Zack.
You wanna come, Lily?
August asked.
Yes, ma'am.
Draping the hives. I had no idea what that was, but you couldn't have paid me $50 to miss it. After Clayton said goodbye, we fastened on our hats and veils and went out to the hives, bearing armloads of black crepe material cut in giant squares. August showed us how to drape a square over each hive box, securing it with a brick and making sure we left the bee's entrance door open. I watched how August stood a moment before each hive with her fingers knitted together under her chin. Exactly what are we doing this for, I wanted to know, but it seemed like a holy ritual I shouldn't interrupt. When we had all the hives covered, we stood under the pines and gazed at them, this little town of black buildings, a city of mourning. Even the humming turned gloomy under the black drapes, low and long, like foghorns must sound going across the sea at night. August pulled off her hat and walked to the lawn chairs in the backyard, with me and Zack tagging behind her. We sat with the sun behind us, staring out toward the wailing wall.
A long time ago, beekeepers always covered their hives when someone in their family died, said August.
How come? I asked.
Covering the hives was supposed to keep the bees from leaving. You see,
The last thing they wanted was their bees swarming off when a death took place. Having bees around was supposed to ensure that the dead person would live again.
My eyes grew wide.
Really?
Tell her about Aristaeus, Zack said.
Oh, yes, Aristaeus. Every beekeeper should know that story.
She smiled at me in a way that made me feel I was about to get part two of the beekeeper's induction, part one being the sting.
Aristaeus was the first keeper of bees. One day, all his bees died, punishment by the gods for something bad that Aristaeus had done. The gods told him to sacrifice a bull to show he was sorry, and then return to the carcass in 9 days and look inside it. Well, Aristaeus did just what they said, and when he came back, he saw a swarm of bees fly out of the dead bull. His own bees, reborn. He took them home to his hives, and after that, people believed that bees had power over death. The kings in Greece made their tombs in the shape of beehives for that very reason.
Zack sat with his elbows on his knees, staring at the circle of grass, still fat and emerald green from our dance in the sprinkler.
When a bee flies, a soul will rise, he said.
I gave him a blank look.
It's an old saying, August said. It means a person's soul will be reborn into the next life if bees are around.
Is that in the Bible? I said.
August laughed. No, but back when the Christians hid from the Romans down in the catacombs, they used to scratch pictures of bees on the walls to remind each other that when they died, they'd be resurrected.
I shoved my hands under my thighs and sat up, trying to picture catacombs, whatever they were.
Do you think putting black cloths over the hives will help May get to heaven? I asked.
Goodness, no. August said.
Putting black cloths on the hives is for us. I do it to remind us that life gives way into death, and then death turns around and gives way into life.
I leaned back in my chair, gazing at the sky, how endless it was, the way it fit down over the world like the lid of a hive. I wished more than anything we could bury May in a beehive tomb, that I could myself lie down in one and be reborn. When the Daughters of Mary showed up, they were loaded down with food. The last time I'd seen them, Queenie and her daughter Violet had on the smallest hats in the group, and this time they'd left them off completely. I think it was because Queenie hated to cover the whiteness of her hair, which she was proud to have, and Violet, who had to be 40 at least, couldn't bring herself to wear a hat if her mother wasn't wearing one. If Queenie went into the kitchen and stuck her head in the oven, Violet would go stick hers in, too. Lunel, Maybelline, Cressy, and Sugar Girl each wore a black hat, not as spectacular as the previous ones, except for Lunel's, which had both a red veil and a red feather. They took off their hats and lined them up on the piano as soon as they came in, so that you wanted to say, "What's the use?" They got underway slicing ham, laying out fried chicken, shaking paprika on the deviled eggs. We had green beans, turnips, macaroni and cheese, caramel cake, all kinds of funeral foods. We ate standing in the kitchen holding paper plates, saying how much May would have liked everything. When we were so full that what we needed was a nap, we went to the parlor and sat with May. The daughters passed around a wooden bowl full of something they called manna. A salted mixture of sunflower, sesame, pumpkin, and pomegranate seeds drizzled with honey and baked to perfection. They ate it by the handfuls, saying they wouldn't dream of sitting with the dead without eating seeds. Seeds kept the living from despair, they explained.
Maybelline said, "She looks good. Doesn't she look good?"
Queenie snorted.
"If she looks that good, maybe we ought to put her on display in the drive-by window at the funeral home."
"Oh, Queenie," cried Maybelline. Cressy noticed Rosaline and me sitting there in the dark and said,
The funeral home in town has a drive-by window. It used to be a bank. Nowadays, they put the open casket right up in the window where we used to drive through and get our checks cashed, said Queenie. People can drive through and pay their respects without having to get out. They even send the guest book out in the drawer for you to sign.
You ain't serious, said Rosaline.
Oh, yeah, Queenie said. We're serious. They might have been speaking the truth, but they didn't look serious. They were falling on each other laughing, and there was May dead. Lunel said, I drove in there one time to see Mrs. Lamar after she passed, since I used to work for her way back when. The woman who sat in the window beside her casket used to be the bank teller there, and when I drove off, she said, You have a nice day now. I turned to August, who was wiping her eyes from tears of hilarity. I said, You won't let them put May in the bank window, will you?
Honey, don't worry about it, said Sugar Girl. The drive-by window is at the white people's funeral home. They're the only ones with enough money to fix up something that ridiculous.
They all broke down again with hysterics, and I couldn't help laughing, too, partly with relief that people would not be joyriding through the funeral home to see May, and partly because you could not help laughing at the sight of all the daughters laughing. But I will tell you this secret thing, which not one of them saw, not even August, the thing that brought me the most cause for gladness. It was how Sugar Girl said what she did, like I was truly one of them. Not one person in the room said, Sugar Girl, really? Talking about white people like that, and we have a white person present. They didn't even think of me being different. Up until then, I'd thought that white people and colored people getting along was the big aim. But after that, I decided everybody being colorless together was a better plan. I thought of that policeman, Eddie Hazelwurst, saying I lowered myself to be in this house of colored women. And for the very life of me, I couldn't understand how it had turned out this way, how colored women had become the lowest ones on the totem pole. You only had to look at them to see how special they were, like hidden royalty among us. Eddie Hazelwurst. What a shit bucket. I felt so warm inside toward them, I thought to myself that if I should die, I would be glad to go on display in the bank window and give the daughters of Mary a good laugh. On the second morning of the vigil, long before the daughters arrived, even before June came downstairs, August found May's suicide note caught beneath the roots of a live oak, not 10 yards from the spot she died. The woods had buried it under fresh-sprouted leaves, the kind that shoot up overnight. Rosaline was making banana cream pie in honor of May, and I was sitting at the table working on my cereal and trying to find something decent on the transistor radio when August burst into the kitchen holding the note with two hands like the words might fall off if she wasn't real careful. She yelled up the stairs, June, come on down here. I found a note from May. August spread it out on the table and stood over it with her hands pressed together. I turned off the plastic radio and stared at the crinkled stiff paper, how the words were faded from being outside. June's bare feet slapped the stairs, and she broke into the room. Oh, God, August, what does it say?
It's so May, August said, and she lifted up the note and read it to us. Dear August and June, I'm sorry to leave you like this. I hate you being sad, but think how happy I'll be with April, Mama, Papa, and Big Mama. Picture us up there together, and that will help some. I'm tired of carrying around the weight of the world. I'm just gonna lay it down now. It's my time to die, and it's your time to live. Don't mess it up. Love, May. August laid down the note and turned to June. She opened her arms wide, and June walked into them. They clung to each other, big sister to little sister, bosom to bosom, their chins wrapped around each other's necks. They stayed that way long enough for me to wonder,
Should Rosaline and I leave the room? But finally they unwound themselves, and we all sat with the smell of banana cream pie. June said, "Do you think it was really her time to die?"
"I don't know," said August. "Maybe it was. But one thing May was right about is that it's our time to live. It's her dying wish that we do that, June. So we need to see to it, all right?"
"What do you mean?" said June. We watched August walk over to the window, put her hands on the countertop, and gaze out at the sky. It was aquamarine and shiny as taffeta. You had the feeling she was making a big decision. June pulled out a chair and sat down.
"August, what?"
When August turned back, her jaw was set.
"I'm going to say something to you, June."
She walked over and stood in front of her.
"You've been halfway living your life for too long. Meg was saying that when it's time to die, go ahead and die. And when it's time to live, live. Don't sort of maybe live, but live like you're going all out, like you're not afraid."
"I don't know what you're talking about," June said.
"I'm saying, marry Neil."
"What?"
"Ever since Melvin Edwards backed out of your wedding all those years back, you've been afraid of love, refusing to take a chance. Like May said, it's your time to live. Don't mess it up."
June's mouth sat open in a wide circle, and not a word crossed her lips. Suddenly the air was coated with the smell of burning. Rosaline flung open the oven and yanked out the pie to find every last meringue tip scorched.
"We'll eat it like that," said August. "A little burned taste never hurt anybody."
Every day for 4 days straight, we kept the vigil. August had May's note with her at all times, tucked in her pocket or slipped under her belt if she had on a no-pocket dress. I watched June, how she seemed quieter since August had lowered the boom on her about Neil. Not exactly sulking. Contemplating is more like it. I would catch her sitting beside the coffin, leaning her forehead against it, and you could tell she was doing more than saying goodbye to May. She was trying to find her own answers to things. One afternoon, August and Zack and I went out to the hives and took off the black cloths. August said we couldn't leave them on too long, since the bees had memorized everything about their hive, and a change like that could make them disoriented. They might not find their way home again, she said.
"Tell me about it," I thought.
The Daughters of Mary showed up each day just before lunch and sat in the parlor with May through the afternoon, telling stories about her. We cried a good bit also, but I could tell we were starting to feel better about saying goodbye. I only hoped May was feeling all right about it, too. Neil stayed at the house nearly as much as the daughters and seemed downright confused by the way June stared into his face. She could barely play the cello because it meant turning loose of his hand. To tell the truth, the rest of us spent nearly as much time watching June and Neil as we did seeing May into the next life. On the afternoon that the funeral home came to pick up May for the burial, bees buzzed around the front window screens. As the coffin was loaded into the hearse, bee hum swelled and blended into the late afternoon colors. Yellow gold, red, tinges of brown. I could still hear them humming at the graveside, even though we were miles away in a colored cemetery with crumbled markers and weeds. The sound carried on the breezes while we huddled together and watched them lower May's coffin into the ground. August passed around a paper bag full of manna, and we scooped up handfuls and threw the seeds into the hole with the coffin, and my ears filled with nothing but bee hum. That night, in my bed in the honey house, when I closed my eyes, bee hum ran through my body, ran through the whole earth. It was the oldest sound there was. Souls flying away.
It takes honeybee workers 10 million foraging trips to gather enough nectar to make 1 pound of honey. Bees of the World. Chapter 11. After May's burial, August shut down honey making, honey selling, even bee patrol. She and June took the meals that Rosaline cooked to their rooms. I barely saw August except in the mornings when she crossed the yard headed toward the woods. She would wave at me, and if I ran over and asked where she was going, could I come too, she would smile and say, not today, that she was still doing her morning. Sometimes she would stay out in the woods past lunch. I had to fight an impulse to say, but I need to talk to you. Life was so funny. I'd spent over a month here dilly-dallying around, refusing to tell August about my mother when I could have done it so easy. And now that I really needed to tell her, I couldn't. You just don't interrupt somebody's morning with your own problems. I helped Rosaline some in the kitchen, but mostly I was free to lie around and write in my notebook. I wrote so many things from my heart that I used up all the pages. It surprised me no end how much I missed our ordinary routine life. The simple act of pouring wax into a candle mold or repairing a broken hive box, kneeling between August and June for evening prayers to Our Lady. I walked in the woods in the afternoon when I was sure August wasn't out there. I would pick out a tree and say, if a bird lands in that tree before I count to 10, that is my mother sending her sign of love. When I got to 7, I would start counting real slow, dragging it out. I would get to 50 sometimes, and no bird. I studied my map of South Carolina at night when everyone was asleep, trying to figure where me and Rosaline might head next. I'd always wanted to see the rainbow-colored houses of Charleston, how they had real horse and buggies on the street, but as appealing as all that was, it nearly crushed me to think of leaving. And even if another cantaloupe truck miraculously appeared and drove us down there, Rosaline and I would have to get jobs somewhere, rent a place to stay, and hope nobody asked any questions. Sometimes I didn't even feel like getting out of bed. I took to wearing my days of the week panties out of order. It could be Monday and I'd have on underwear saying Thursday. I just didn't care. The only time I saw June was when Neil came over, which was every single day. She would come out wearing hoop earrings, and off they'd go, taking long rides in his car, which she said did her a world of good. The wind rearranged her thoughts, and the countryside made her see all the life still left out there waiting to be lived. Neil would get behind the wheel, and June would slide over on the front seat so she was practically under the wheel with him. Honestly, I worried for their safety. Zack showed up a few times, just to visit, and found me in the lawn chair with my legs tucked under me, reading back over my notebook. Sometimes when I saw him, my stomach went through a series of sudden drops and lurches. You are one-third friend, one-third brother, one-third bee partner, and one-third boyfriend, I told him. He explained to me I had one too many thirds in the equation, which of course I knew, as I am bad in math but not that bad. We stared at each other as I tried to figure out which third would get deleted. I said, if I was a Negro girl, he placed his fingers across my lips so I tasted his saltiness. We can't think of changing our skin, he said. Change the world, that's how we gotta think. All he could talk about was going to law school and busting ass. He didn't say white ass, and I was thankful for that. But I believe that's what he meant. There was a place inside him now that hadn't been there before. Heated, charged, angry. Coming into his presence was like stepping up to a gas heater, to a row of blue fire burning in the dark, wet curve of his eyes. His conversations were all about the race riots in New Jersey, policemen taking their nightsticks to Negro boys who threw rocks, about Molotov cocktails, sit-ins, righteous causes, Malcolm X, and the Afro-American Unity Group giving the Ku Klux Klan a taste of their own medicine. I wanted to say to Zack,
Remember when we ate May's Kool-Aid ice under the pine trees? Remember when you sang Blueberry Hill? Remember? After non-stop mourning all week, just when I thought we would go on forever in our private, grieving worlds and never again eat another meal together or work side by side in the honey house, I found Rosaline in the kitchen, laying the table for four, using a sun